True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
In 2006, 33-year-old Michelle Lanahan was visited by the Alaska police regarding a murder back in 1996. Back then, Michelle had been working as an exotic dancer. The murder victim was a former client of hers named Kent LaPink. But in 2006, Michelle was a professional woman, married to a physician and raising a young daughter in Washington State. So her arrest was shocking to the people in her community. Join us at the quiet end for The Fisherman and the Flirt. Michelle had been dancing at the Great Alaskan Bush Company for only a few months when she met Kent LaPink. He was infatuated with Michelle, and soon he told people that she was his fiance. But Michelle said that they were never engaged and were not in a romantic relationship at all. So there are many, many sides to this story, and I really can't wait to dive in and see if we can separate fact from fiction here.
It might be difficult.
It might be, but we do have opinions. We can talk about it.
Before we get started, I'm just going to give a shout out to Cleo, one of our loyal listeners. And if we get to CrimeCon next year or the year after, whenever, maybe we can get together.
That would be great. It's been a long time since we've met up with any listeners in person.
Yes. It's been a long time since we've met any other people.
True story, yes.
All right, beer for today. We have an Alaska case, so I'm doing an Alaska beer. It's called Fallen Angel, brewed by Midnight Sun Brewing Company. This is a Belgian strong pale ale, about 8% alcohol by volume. Nice beer. Clear gold color, small white head, some grassy hops, citrus, little sweet malt. Taste-wise, we got some lemon, bread, some hops, a little bit of funk. You know, that horse blankety smell you get sometimes.
I love the funk. Gotta have that funk.
It feels pretty nice in the mouth.
All right, let's open it up and give it a try. I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, it's a different one.
Yeah.
At least from us.
Absolutely. All right, Dickie, come sit beside me. We're going to talk about this case, and I know you're going to have a lot of opinions, which I look forward to hearing.
I'm sure you do. So Michelle was born Michelle Hughes in New Orleans. This was in 1972. Her father was a captain in the Air Force, and he was the first of her mother Sandy's two husbands. Both of her marriages did end in divorce. Now her father, Michelle's father, was in the Air Force, so the family moved from city to city quite often. And when she was 12, her father died, and Sandy married an airline employee. So frequent moves continue to be the norm for this family.
That can be tough when you're growing up like that.
Oh, can it?
It really can.
Yeah.
Although I think on the other hand, you can learn some more independence that way, because you have to go in and adapt to new people frequently. So it can be something that really teaches you some social skills.
I think the good points outweigh the bad points.
Do you?
Yeah. But you also have to have a child who's willing to do that. I mean, if all they're going to do is pout and be pissed off that you've moved them, you're not going to get very far.
That's true.
So you got to emphasize the positives.
Well, I think Michelle did pretty well socially, at least with the male portion of the population. She did better with guys than with girls.
So when she was almost 12, she was diagnosed with scoliosis. And that's curvature of the spine. I think people recognize that, right?
For the most part, I think so.
Okay. So treatment for this is wearing of a back brace, at least if it's enough to intervene. The first step you do is wear a back brace. And that requires a lot of doctor visits for adjustment of the brace and stuff. Now, apparently, the brace didn't do what they wanted it to do because Michelle ended up having a steel rod implanted in her spine. These are called Harrington rods, and this is what kind of the ultimate treatment for scoliosis is. You just straighten that curve out with the bar.
Yeah, that's just hard for me to picture, because how do you bend or anything? How long is this bar?
It's not long. You still have pretty full movement, so it's you just don't bend the part of the spine that has the rod implanted.
Okay. It sounds like a brutal surgery to me, but maybe it's not as bad as it sounds. There's just something about steel rod that is intimidating.
You're thinking, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think it had to be at least emotionally traumatic, even though...
Oh, absolutely.
She got out of the brace, and it did correct the problem, so that's the ultimate thing.
Yeah, although if you're a teenager, young teenager, and you've been wearing a back brace for a while, in her case about a year, and it didn't do the trick, and then you're faced with surgery that has some downtime and recovery time, you might not be real happy.
You might not, but you might be really relieved to get rid of the brace.
Possibly.
But she seemed to do okay. In her teens, she attended St. Scholastica Academy in Covington, Louisiana, and really excelled in her classes for a while. But then she decided to drop out and move to New York to become a model. But she didn't even make it to New York. She ended up working as a receptionist at a modeling agency in New Jersey, hoping to maybe pick up some modeling jobs for herself. But she didn't book any modeling jobs. She did, though, find good pay working as a stripper, an exotic dancer. In fact, she started stripping when she was only 14, according to the police. Now, her mother would argue that. But according to the police, it was 1987 when 14-year-old Michelle took her 17-year-old sister Melissa's ID, left New Orleans, and traveled to Ocean County, New Jersey. And using Melissa's ID, she worked as a stripper in several of the area clubs. So that's pretty bold for a 14-year-old.
Boy, I guess.
Now, like I said, though, Michelle's mother disagrees with this version of events, and she insisted that Michelle left home at the age of 16, and she had her mother's consent. I'd still have to argue that's quite young to leave home.
Yeah, I mean, 14, 16, you're splitting hairs to me.
So it points to some kind of unhappiness. Or dissatisfaction with home life.
Yeah, I get the impression something must have been going on, right?
Yeah, but I mean, teenagers are a quirky lot, and who knows? Sometimes teenagers are just tough to deal with, and they want to get away.
Yeah, but the mom had to make sure that the point was driven home, that she was 16, not 14, and
it was
with her consent.
And that's funny.
So it sounds like she's trying to atone for something.
Yeah, but why would you even give consent to a 16-year-old to do that?
That's where I don't find the story real true.
Yeah. So I'm kind of leaning towards the police version. But even if I give her own version, 16's pretty damn young.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, she grew up fast. Probably that contributed to it. In her late teens, she began dating a man in his late 30s. And for about 3 years, she lived and worked with this man who owned a deli in Bricktown. So Michelle left the deli owner and New Jersey in 1993. She returned to New Orleans, where she worked in restaurants and did some studying to get her GED. Michelle said that she wanted to go to college and become a veterinarian. She really loved animals. That's one really good thing about her. She told her family she was going to take a job stripping at a New Orleans club where she could earn more money than she could in a restaurant and save up her money for college. Her mother and her sister were unhappy about this decision, but once Michelle made up her mind, there wasn't much she could do. She was a force.
Yes, she was. And actually, she became one of the more popular dancers in the club. And by the time she turned 21, she had decided to move to Anchorage, Alaska, because she heard that exotic dancers made big money in Alaska.
That's super far away, and I wonder where she got this idea.
Well, she and a dancer friend from the New Orleans club drove to Anchorage, and they got jobs at the Great Alaskan Bush Company, where Michelle went by the stage name Bobby Joe. By the way, who named this bar, this strip joint? A 12-year-old? The Great Alaskan Bush Company? Come on.
Yeah, I know, but it's a play on words.
Oh, thank you. I didn't understand that part.
But, you know, I imagine there are a lot more men than women in Alaska, so it's probably a big thing to go to the clubs. And there's guys down there working and making a lot of money and don't have a lot of things to spend it on.
Yeah, there's money to be made, I'm sure.
Absolutely, there really was. And by that time, she'd really learned the tricks of the trade, especially how to charm men into giving her cash and expensive gifts. so she didn't even spend that much time on the stage.
No, there's other ways of making money.
Right, so she did dance on the stage, but she also did a lot of personal lap dances for her customers. And a lot of her time was spent just socializing with the men. Some of them were just lonely. And she was beautiful, and she knew what to say, so she did get some very large tips.
Yeah, so she'd go home from work every night, and she'd count her money there on the kitchen table. It could be as much as $2,000 on a busy night. So she wasn't the best dancer, not by a long shot. But she had this innate ability to charm and manipulate customers, and that made her one of the club's hottest attractions. Men would pay hundreds of dollars just to spend time with her. And they often ended up becoming convinced that they were special, and they had a chance of a romantic relationship with her. That's just what she wants them to think, right?
I would imagine. I don't think she had any feelings for most of these guys. But then in August of 1994, Michelle met a guy named James Scott Hilke, and he went by his middle name Scott. Scott had traveled to Anchorage for a job with the Light and Power Company, and this was his first time in Alaska. He arrived 2 weeks early for the new job and decided to kill some time by hanging out at the Great Alaskan Bush Company. Michelle introduced herself to him as Bobby Joe, her stage name. And that night was no different than any other. She just approached him as she would any other customer. But it turned out they really hit it off more than usual, and she really liked him. She ended up giving him her phone number after spending most of one evening just talking with him, and of course getting a lot of money from him. So I'm not sure how that works. You sit down and they just hand you money. I guess I'm stupid.
What, for a lap dance?
Well, no, for just hanging out with them sometimes. She didn't even have to do anything but talk to them.
No, not that I have this as personal knowledge, but you pay a sum of money for companionship for X amount of time.
Oh, so she says, well, I really love talking to you, but I really have to go do this. And he says, oh, no, I'll pay you for another hour, something like that.
Yeah. You can keep it going.
Yeah, right. So Scott and Michelle did seem like an odd match. He was good-looking enough, this tall guy with dirty blonde hair, kind of rugged. But again, he was a lot older. He was 17 years older than her.
And she likes the older guys.
She does. And I don't know if that's because she likes the money. Might be. But he did make a good living. He was far from wealthy, but he didn't have a lot of things to spend his money on. And he was making good money. At the time, he was separated from his wife, but he would be divorced in about a year. When he came into the club, he never showed any signs of jealousy when Michelle was with other guys, so she liked that. After a few weeks, Michelle was letting Scott sleep over at her apartment, and because he still traveled a lot for work, he had many thousands of frequent flyer miles, and this was a big benefit, big bonus for her, because he'd use them taking her on all these great trips.
Yeah, nice deal.
Yeah.
Michelle, over time, was able to save up enough money to buy her own house. So in Thanksgiving of 1994, Scott proposed to her, and she accepted. But we had some difficulties. By March of 1995, Scott had quit his job, and he had tried to start a consulting business. He lost money doing that, and then he burned through most of his 401k plan. So big financial crunch for him. Things between the couple went downhill.
Well, because let's be honest, it had to be at least partially based on finances.
I think it was more than partially.
Well, I'm trying to be generous here and be the devil's advocate.
Yeah, well, anyway, when he had more money, relationship was better.
Mm-hmm.
When he didn't have it, things went downhill.
Well, right, and in the early days of the relationship, he wasn't jealous, and he didn't seem to mind the attention that Michelle was getting from other men. But over time, he started recognizing that she had these regular customers that maybe weren't that different from him.
Duh, yeah.
So they'd come into the club and spend time with her and give her money, and he started feeling unsure of what her feelings really were. Did she care about him? Or was this just all manipulation? It's just her way of making money. It's hard for him to figure that out.
Oh, come on. It's all business.
Well, I don't know if it was all business, because she did continue to see him. But we'll see. I'm trying to be more generous here than you are. Back in September of 1994, Michelle had introduced Scott to a regular named Kent Lepink. Kent was tall, balding, and shy. Scott knew that Michelle was grooming Kent for his money, because he was this awkward guy and just an easy mark.
Well, Scott knows the deal, right? He was kind of the predecessor of Kent.
Well, yeah, I think as he kind of distanced himself a bit, he started to see things a little more clearly. But he was still really into her.
Yeah, well, like she was beautiful. She's a good-looking woman.
Yes.
So Michelle began to see Kent outside of the club as well. Kent fished. He was a fisherman. And during the winter of 1994-95, which is the off-season for fishermen up there, apparently, he had nothing else to do but focus all his attention on Michelle. As far as anyone else could tell, Michelle was not serious about Kent. He was more like her errand boy. You know, whatever she wanted done, she asked him and he'd take care of it for her.
Yeah, but for Kent, this was true love, I think.
It was.
He went home to visit his family over the holidays in Michigan and showed them photos of Michelle. He was so proud of her. He said that he had moved in with her, but he never mentioned other men. He never mentioned Scott. But Scott still stayed with Michelle whenever he was in Alaska. While Kent was in Michigan going on and on about how wonderful Michelle was and their plans for the future, she'd actually traveled to Disney World with Scott and one of his relatives, using those frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, so to Michelle's friends and co-workers, Kent was kind of pathetic. He came into the bush, as they called it, night after night, spent hundreds of dollars just to spend time with Michelle.
So, that's so sad. It does seem like he must have been super lonely to do that.
Oh, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's sad.
We'll hear more about him, but he didn't have an easy life either.
No, he had some issues.
Yeah. Now, by the summer of 1995, Kent was busy fishing again. And at that point, that time of her life, Michelle started spending more time with another customer. This is John Carlin III. So she's spreading herself a little thin here.
Well, these were her three main ones, but of course she had quite a few regulars.
Yeah. So Carlin lived with his teenage son in a house near the club. He was a former Marine and a steelworker. Now, he had suffered lead poisoning on the job and had received an $800,000 settlement. So he was definitely more financially well off.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot
of money. Yeah, it is.
But he was well off enough that he didn't hesitate to drop thousands of dollars on his favorite dancer. Guess who? Bobby Joe. So here's a third guy with loneliness and money.
That's what she was looking for.
Got it.
Now, Scott was less than thrilled when Michelle announced that she was traveling to Europe for a trip with Carlin. She even asked Scott to take care of her pets while she was away.
Insult to injury, huh?
Yeah. So when Scott expressed not being real happy with that, Michelle assured him that there was no reason to worry. She told him that Carlin was impotent and they were just good friends. So she was good at stringing these guys along.
I guess. Well, gotta know how to work it.
So in the autumn of 1995, Scott had stopped hanging out at the bush. His former boss hired him to work for a new company. So this meant less time for Michelle, as the territory he covered was in Mississippi, Canada, Hawaii, and Alaska. So he was only in Alaska part of the time.
How'd Mississippi get in? I mean, Alaska, Hawaii, Canada, sure. But Mississippi?
Well, whatever company
whatever he was working for.
Yeah. Yeah. He did continue the relationship with Michelle, like I said, but now he only saw her, like, for a weekend once or twice a month. They did travel together once in a while. They even went to Louisiana to see Michelle's family once. But overall, Scott was really getting tired of sharing her with these two other guys that he really saw as complete morons. Because these guys were just kind of socially awkward and following her like puppies. And Scott didn't see himself that way.
No. So that October 1995, Scott's helping Michelle with some home repairs, and he found extensive dry rot in the wood, so she had to find a new place to live. And while she's doing that, she decided to move in with John Carlin and his son. So that move was the end of things for Scott, and he just figured, hell with this. Michelle was accepting money, jewelry, and other extravagant gifts from Carlin and Kent. Both men were always around her.
Well, yeah, and one trip that Scott and Michelle took to New Orleans, Kent apparently followed them and just showed up unexpectedly. He just socially didn't know how to get cues, I guess. The engagement with Scott and Michelle was called off, but Scott kept sleeping with her.
Well, gotta have some benefits still, right?
Right. and they did spend Christmas of 95 together at Carlin's house. Anne continued to hook up during some weekends in 1996. They even ended up spending several days together in a condo in Lake Tahoe in late April and early May of 1996.
So let me tell you a little bit about Kent Lepping. He was one of Kenneth and Betsy's Lepping's four sons. He grew up with a love of the outdoors. He really liked to hunt and fish from teenage years onward. Now, his family owned a successful Midwestern grocery chain in Michigan, and he started out working for the family business, like two of his three brothers. But his employment ended abruptly, and I mean abruptly, in 1991 when his family found out that he had embezzled from the business. They didn't pursue criminal charges, but Kent had to give up all his stock in the company, and that was worth over $1 million. According to court documents, Kent had embezzled over $100,000. But then he made things worse, because he committed arson in an attempt to collect insurance money. Now, he didn't get the money because he was so completely obvious about the arson job that they knew it was arson.
Right, so, but no charges were filed on that.
Well, that's nice of his parents.
Well, I kind of think maybe it should have been. He was the black sheep of the family, but I think there's another component to this. I think he wasn't a bad guy necessarily. I think there were some mental health issues. Well, maybe he was just a little slow. There was something not quite 100% about his thinking process.
Oh, it couldn't have been. I mean, this is a family business, and he's stealing $100,000 from him?
Yeah, and why did he even need to do that? So that leads me to think he had issues with his brothers and his parents. If he had these brothers and they were much more highly functional than he was, it had to be a difficult childhood and adulthood being part of the family.
I'm sure it was.
So there are a lot of family things going on there that we're not privy to. But without a job, Kent decided to travel to Tennessee, and he studied taxidermy at a game farm outside of Nashville. While there, he attended a safari club convention in Nevada, and this was a popular meeting of big game hunters who often wanted mounted trophies. While there, Kent met Russ Williams, an Alaska fisherman, who invited Kent to work over the summer of 1993 as a crewman on his fishing tender boat.
Yeah, so a tender, this is a seagoing vessel that's used to ferry fish catches from netting boats to canneries.
That seems like a pretty good deal. I think it would be easier than fishing.
It probably would be, but still have all sorts of things that can go wrong on the seas. Have to be careful.
Right.
So the job they had was to pick up salmon from vessels that hauled in fish by the waters of Prince William Sound. The boats would unload their fish into the tenders, which were then rushed to canneries in the nearest port. Then they were processed from there.
Well, yeah, and if they're busy, you make a good living doing that. You get a good percentage of the take.
You certainly can.
But Kent's enthusiasm for the fishing industry in Alaska was really impressive to his father, who, of course, had had problems with him, and who was feeling terrible about kicking him out of the family business. After Kent's first season in fishing was successful, his father, Ken, took Betsy and son Ransom to visit Kent the following summer. So mom and dad and brother. Ransom was one of his brothers, and they had two more sons. But I guess all the sons were really on edge about Kent's embezzlement from the family business, and the parents were trying to fix things in the family. So they decided they'd take each son one at a time to see how well Kent was doing in Alaska, and Ransom was the first one that they took. But of course, the other ones would never get a chance to go. After visiting Kent aboard his tender, Kent agreed to finance him in his own commercial fishing business. So with this family money behind him, Kent purchased a tender and he began working for himself. So it seems like his family was pretty good to him.
Well, it sure does.
They were giving him a lot of chances here.
This is what he was up to when he first stopped by the Alaskan Bush Company. And the first night he goes, he meets Bobby Joe, and that's all she wrote. He's just completely smitten by her. And within a few weeks, Bobby Joe is all that Kent could think about.
Yeah, so I really think he must have been in love with her. But then there was this issue of his sexual orientation. That had been questioned by a lot of people who knew him. And some people believed he was homosexual or bisexual. Whatever it was, he just seemed head over heels for Michelle. and he became a willing participant in her manipulation. But the strange thing is that he never did have sex with her. But on the other hand, Michelle had sex with several other men. Before his death, Kent made what was seen as a homosexual advance on the teenage John Carlin IV, and this upset the boy, infuriated the boy's dad, who called the police and reported that Kent had thrust his hips at the boy and said some inappropriate things to him. Police officers showed up and interviewed the boy, but no charges were filed. The incident apparently was resolved when John Carlin III talked with Kent about his inappropriate sense of humor, and I guess it ended there.
So that cleared the air.
That's the suggestion, yes.
I'd be suspicious, I guess that's the word for it, if I'm dating this gorgeous woman and we're not having sex.
Well, yeah, but I think it was his choice.
Right.
He decided that Michelle was the only woman for him. He proposed to her in November of 1994, and that was just a month after they met. He gave her a diamond ring, which she accepted, and then after she had accepted his proposal, that's when he notified his family, all excited, and started making plans. But no date was set, and then Kent told Michelle that they should celebrate their love by postponing having sex until their honeymoon. So that's kind of strange. It's not like she's this virginal woman.
No. And it seems like from her standpoint, she'd want to have sex with him to keep him coming back.
She was probably willing. I'm not sure. But later, she would just deny the whole thing. She'd say, we were never engaged. We were never romantic.
Yeah.
Which just is not believable to me. I don't think he's just going to say that.
Exactly. Kent was positive, though, that he and Michelle would be getting married. However, he started running out of money. His tender business wasn't doing as well as he was hoping. And he noticed that Michelle was starting to distance herself from him.
Yeah, it seems like when money got short, she kind of distanced herself. And this is kind of a technique in my eyes, like, oh, you're not going to buy me things. I'm going to kind of passive-aggressively spend less time with you. And then you're going to find a way to come up with more money.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he just didn't seem to get it. They had gone ahead and set some tentative dates for their wedding, but they didn't have a specific date. And I think he was starting to worry a little if she was even going to go through with it. But he was really happy and excited telling his parents about it. And Kent's dad, Ken, flew up to Alaska and was helping sort out money and plan a date for the wedding. But on the day his father was to arrive, Kent called his mom in Michigan and told her that Michelle was missing. He believed she'd gone to a cabin in this tiny town 90 miles away from Anchorage, a town called Hope. He told his mother that he was going to drive to Hope and look for Michelle. So Kent had found a note in the house he shared with Michelle and John Carlin III, and it suggested that Michelle was having a secret rendezvous with an unknown man in Hope.
Yeah, the note, which investigators would later call the Hope Note, led Kent to believe that Carlin had purchased a cabin in Hope, Alaska, and was inviting Michelle up there to use it. But there was no cabin. They'd made it all up.
Yeah, but the cabin definitely sounds real in this typed-up note. It looks like it was written to look like a conversation between Carlin and Michelle, and that it was meant for Kent to find it. In this note, Carlin writes that he fixed the roof and cleaned the fireplace. You guys enjoy your stay, he says, making it sound like Michelle wouldn't be alone, but with someone else. And she responds, great. Please don't let anyone know where we're at. Love you and thanks again. So prosecutors would believe that this note was meant to lure Kent to Hope in search of Michelle, who was actually away in Lake Tahoe with Scott Hilke. And this worked. They're trying to get him up there to kill him.
Jill, what did you put in the blender?
My Bluetooth earbuds. If I hear another piece of shit commercial, I'm going to scream.
That's a little extreme, don't you think? I can't help you with other podcasts, but all of our True Crime Brewery episodes now come with commercial-free versions for our Tide Grabber subscribers.
Well, I know. My hate for ads is what motivated me to give Tide Grabber members that ad-free option. If you subscribe at tiegrabber.com, you get to listen to all of our new episodes commercial-free, and this is in addition to our bonus episodes every month. Plus, you get some great TCB swag mailed to you when you join.
Okay, I get it. At least TCB listeners can avoid ads. Just turn off the damn blender. You're going to wake up the whole neighborhood.
Okay, I'm sorry for swearing.
Not a fucking problem.
Kent drove 90 miles down the highway, bringing along a photo of Michelle, and he stopped in at a local cafe to ask around. He told people that she was his fiancée and she was in town for the weekend to help a friend, but no one had seen her, you know, obviously because she wasn't there.
Right.
So Kent returned to Anchorage alone and picked up his dad at the airport, and he told his father that Michelle was up in Hope with a friend, and that John Carlin knew where she was but wouldn't tell him. So this was supposed to be when his father would meet Michelle and help plan the wedding. So this had to be really humiliating for
yes.
Kent.
Yeah.
While Ken was with Kent, Kent reached into his pocket and gave his dad an envelope that held a change of beneficiary to a life insurance policy. This was a $1 million policy on Kent's life. Kent, now unable to find Michelle and pretty upset about it, had changed the beneficiary from Michelle to his own parents and one of his brothers. The policy, Kent told his father, was a wedding gift from Michelle's grandfather, so that was very curious.
Boy, I guess.
And Ken was getting worried about his son.
Yeah, he said something like, nobody gives a life insurance policy for a wedding present. Probably not. Kent, this is dangerous. You better cancel this policy. You better do something with it really quick. Because I don't like the smell of this.
Well, sure. And I think when he'd gotten his own fishing boat, he and Michelle had decided, oh, we need to get life insurance in case something happens to me. But that's a lot of money, and now she's not even really with him. But his dad tried to help him, and Kent didn't really like that either. He said, I'm a big boy, you know, I can handle myself. But could he really?
Right, apparently not.
I just feel like there was something missing a little bit. And I don't say it to be critical of him at all. I just say it because I think that's what made him an easy target.
Yeah, I think so.
So Kent's father flew home to Michigan, and soon after he received a package from Kent in the mail. The package Kent sent to his parents in Michigan was very strange. It was an envelope containing a letter, and then it had a second sealed envelope with the letter inside. If anything bad should happen to me, Kent had written in the first letter, open that second letter. So here's some of what he wrote. Put the enclosed envelope in your safe deposit box. Do not open it. I talked to you about insurance policies, and this is mine. If I didn't think that things could get a little rough up here, I wouldn't have sent you this. Don't get all nervous and call me on the phone about this.
Yeah, right.
So that terrified his parents, I'm sure.
Yeah, so of course his mom, Betsy, called the number right away. No answer. So she left a message. But Kent was gone. He's just vanished.
Yes, he'd vanished that day.
So an electric lineman named Jim Hardy parked his truck on Hope Road, out in the middle of nowhere. He was on a service call to fix a downed wire, somewhere out there in the woods. He hiked through the brush looking for the utility pole and the line that he was going to repair. He went past a hiking trail, kept going till he got to the pole. At first, he thought the man he saw lying on the ground was just sleeping, you know, because it was a bright sunny morning, and it was possible that someone had wandered off the hiking trail to take a nap in the sun.
Possible, not likely.
Not really.
But I don't think your mind would automatically go to a dead body. It just doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. But as Hardy got closer, he realized very quickly something's very wrong here. The man who had on blue jeans and a red jacket had a bullet hole through his chest and another one in his cheek, and he was dead. So Hardy ran back to his truck to call for help.
Yes, so the first officer to arrive was Sergeant Michael Stickler. He arrived at 1:45 p.m. and did a quick inspection of the scene. He had a really extensive background in firearms and knew that, because empty .44 casings were scattered on the ground, these bullets had been fired from a Desert Eagle semi-automatic pistol. It's a fairly rare gun. A revolver would have retained the spent shells until the shooter removed them from the weapon by hand. A semi-automatic gun flips them out and away from the gun as each shot is fired. And the only semi-automatic pistol that comes in a .44 Magnum caliber is this Israeli-made Desert Eagle gun. So the scattered shells also said something about the shooter because the killer didn't stop to pick up the spent casings. So they were just leaving evidence behind. Which I think is really weird because he was out in the middle of nowhere. Why wouldn't you take a minute to do that?
I know.
So leaving those behind suggests to me that the murderer was either very inexperienced with guns or just kind of freaked out and in a hurry to get out of there, which is understandable.
Quite. So Detective DeHart from the Alaska Department of Public Safety's Major Crimes Unit gets called to the scene. Unlike agencies in other states, Alaska's DPS is the primary law enforcement and public safety organization for most of Alaska. So when Alaska became a state in 1959, it became the biggest state of the United States.
Well, by far, right?
By far.
Yeah.
So there are endless places in Alaska where you could kill someone, dump the body, and it would never be found. If the body was found, but had been left out exposed to the elements, decomposition could make identification really difficult. Could be even worse if the killer or killers stripped the body of anything to identify it, like a wallet. So looking at this body, from the condition, it looked like the guy had been killed during the last couple days. Nights had been cool, so that had likely slowed down the decomposition, which made it possible to get fingerprints. Now, there's also DNA testing that could be used to establish identity, but in the mid-90s, it wasn't as common as it is today.
No, I think it was just really becoming a thing in the early 90s with the O.J. Simpson trial and all that. At least that's the first time I remember really hearing a lot about it in criminal cases. So the coroner, of course, would check for postmortem lividity. Lividity begins 20 minutes to 3 hours after death. And during this process, this is when blood settles or coagulates in the lower part of the body.
Yeah, because it's not being pumped anymore.
Right. So it's just kind of a gravity thing to kind of simplify it.
That's the best way to look at it.
So it causes this purplish-red discoloration of the skin. A coroner can read the lividity to approximate the time of death. And the detective noticed that the man wore some black Converse sneakers and that his ankles were crossed. And that was interesting to me because I remember Joe Kenda saying that that's how dead men fall when they're shot and they die instantly like that.
Huh.
The dead man's fall, I think he called it. Do you recall that?
No, I don't.
Okay. I think it was a few years ago on a very Kenda Christmas. They had a lot of interviews with him, and I remember that. Very interesting. But when searching the body, he found the victim's car keys. He also found a checkbook in the pants pocket. The checkbook showed an account at the First National Bank of Anchorage in the names of Kent J. Lepink and Michelle K. Hughes. And the body was Kent.
So whoever had killed Kent made a big mistake when they didn't strip his body of identification. And in one pocket, there is also New York Life change of beneficiary form, dated April 26, 1996. And according to this document, Lepink had changed his beneficiary on a life insurance policy from Michelle Hughes to Kenneth Lepink. And with it was a U.S. Post Office receipt dated April 30, 1996. So the police investigating this figured the killer wasn't a professional because a professional killer would not leave identification on the body.
At about 4:30 p.m., the remains of Kent were put into a black body bag. Those who lifted it could tell that the corpse was in full rigor mortis, meaning he'd been dead for a good while before the power company worker had showed up. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the autopsy and you can go into rigor mortis. Not personally go into rigor mortis, but you can go into it in the conversation. Talk about it.
So when Kent's remains got to the medical examiner's lab in Anchorage, they were x-rayed while still in the body bag. Then the bag was unzipped, clothing was removed and searched. And then when the clothing was hung up to dry, the pathologist who did this initial exam and would be doing the autopsy noted that Kent's shirt had a large blood stain on the back. So the second bullet hit him in his stomach, but there was very little blood on the outer clothing. So to pathologists, this meant that after the impact, he spun around and fell backwards, never rolled onto his stomach. Then he was shot twice more. So almost all of the bleeding happened when Kent was lying on his back. And that's why there's so much blood on the back of his shirt. Kent's wounds were examined to determine the cause of death. So there was a large hole in his stomach, consistent with a .44 caliber bullet. And higher up from his stomach, there was an elevation on his chest with some bruising. Now, the coroner could feel something hard just under the skin, like a bullet had entered from behind and had been lodged in his chest. On the right cheek, there was a wound that was also consistent with a .44 bullet. So after noting the two wounds on the front of Kent, two wounds to his back were examined. And from the external and internal exams, it looked like Kent had first been shot in the back. This wound was smaller and located in his lower back, but fibers embedded in his body from his T-shirt showed that it was a point-blank shot. Actually, the killer had pushed the gun right up against his back and shot him. Clothing fibers entered the skin and muscle, and gunpowder tore the edges of the wound. In fact, it was fired so close that carbon monoxide penetrated the body tissues and turned the entry area bright red.
So following the path of the bullet, it had traveled upwards, entering Kent's aorta, which of course is the largest blood vessel that takes oxygenated blood from the heart to the rest of the body. And from there it continued until it lodged in the chest just under the skin. So this obviously would have killed him, but he was shot again in the stomach from a bit further away. The shooter fired up into the body, leaving Kent to fall on the steep incline with his feet downhill from his head. This bullet hit Kent's liver, spleen, and lung before exiting out of his back, leaving the largest wound. There were only shards left from the bullet because Kent had been on the ground by then, and the bullet was stopped by the hard ground.
The wound to his face had stippling from gunpowder that tattooed the skin. So we got another close-up shot, probably about 9 inches away from his cheek. That bullet traveled up to his brain and remained there. And the small amount of bleeding from that wound indicated it was probably the final shot that was fired.
But to me, that shows some real hardcore coldness.
I guess so, huh?
Yes.
Now, toxicology findings showed no alcohol or drugs in Kent's system. He had no defensive wounds. He had no signs of being restrained with tape or rope or anything. The killer had to have gotten close enough to shoot him in the back. So that indicated that Kent likely knew who his killer was.
Well, it sure seems to me that he was lured out to this place. And who else would he go there for but Michelle?
Yeah.
He'd go anywhere for her.
The way it's set up, there's no other answer to what's going on.
No, there's no other reason for him to be there. Plus, he'd already told his father and his mother that he was going to Hope looking for Michelle.
So for determining the time of death, pathologists can use the rule of 12. It takes about 12 hours for rigor mortis to set in. It begins with the smaller muscles of the arms, legs, and jaw. It can begin earlier than the 12 hours, but 12 hours is when it's really going strong. Then the entire body is stiff or in rigor for another 12 hours, and then it gets relaxed again. So you got about 24 hours for the whole cycle. So all things considered, the time of death was determined to be around 4 or 5 p.m. Wednesday, May 1st. So this was actually 24 hours before full rigor. But I said the rule of 12 is not engraved in stone, and it can be kind of imprecise depending on the temperature. So we're doing the rule of 12 based on a temperature of 68 degrees. The colder it is, the longer rigor takes to set in. So in Kent's case, his body was out in overnight temperatures that had dropped below freezing. And the day he was found, it was only about 50 degrees. So if you allow for this variation, which is going to screw up your rule of 12, because it certainly was nowhere near 68 degrees.
So it's really kind of a shitty rule.
Well, it's not that precise. Let's just say that.
Very general, yeah.
So the window for the time of his death looked like it was between April 30th and the night of May 1st. And in this window, Michelle's alibi.
Right. She was in Lake Tahoe with Scott Hilke, and he would attest to that.
Right.
But in their search of John Carlin III's house, detectives looked at the room where Kent had been staying. It was very sparsely furnished, almost like he was a monk, but there was a hard plastic gun case in there. And inside there was a pouch with some ammunition magazine and a holster. And the belt was big enough to hold a .44 pistol. But there was no actual gun there. So Carlin told detectives that the gun case and contents belonged to him, not Kent. He had brought it with him when he moved to Alaska from New Jersey, he said, and he claimed that the gun had been stolen back in New Jersey. So why he was hanging on to this without the gun is a little curious to me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
Why bring the case out?
Exactly. And why was it even in Kent's room? But it's just weird to me that Kent was even staying there.
Yeah.
A lot of weirdness going on here.
So the next day, State Trooper Mike Sears drove from Anchorage to Hope. He stopped at a 7-Eleven on the highway and showed Kent's photo to the store clerks and construction workers. But nobody recognized him. The Discovery Cafe, which was one of Hope's two restaurants, was pretty empty of customers. Sears showed the photo to the cook, who remembered seeing Kent a week or so ago. He came in looking for his girlfriend. Kent had shown the cook a picture of himself with a blonde woman, asking if she had seen his fiancée. She hadn't, but they chatted for a bit. The man said that his fiancée was in the area helping friends fix a cabin roof.
While the trooper was in Hope, he wanted to check out a house in a residential subdivision on the main road between Palmer and Wasilla, because this was the address listed on Kent's checks. He was going to look for Michelle Hughes and John Carlin, the owner of the house in Anchorage, the one Kent's driver's license showed as his address. Two troopers showed up there, and they found Michelle, the owner of this house, with Carlin, a balding guy in his 30s, and then Carlin's son, 17-year-old John Carlin IV. So this house was being remodeled. The three of them were working in a storage shed, gathering things to take back to Carlin's house in South Anchorage, where they were staying. They said to the troopers that they were looking for their own possessions, which they believed to be hidden there by their housemate, Kent. They said Kent lived with them when he wasn't sleeping on his boat or fishing in Prince William Sound. He sometimes stole things, they said, and they were trying to get some of them back. The two troopers separated Michelle from Carlin and interviewed them individually. Michelle asked the trooper why they were asking all these questions about Kent, and explained that she had just come back from a vacation at Lake Tahoe with her boyfriend, Scott Hilke. The trooper didn't tell Michelle about the papers they found in Kent's pockets, including the change of beneficiary form. When asked where Kent was, they finally told her that he was dead. His body was found, they said, but they wouldn't tell her how he had died. So as the trooper taped his conversation with Michelle, she started to cry and continued to sob for a couple of minutes. But it kind of came and went quickly, and they were a little suspicious by her reaction.
Once again, we're not acting like we're supposed to.
Right. So Michelle said that her engagement to Kent was just a front for his homosexuality. He hadn't wanted his family to know about it, so he wanted to marry a woman. But this didn't really check out because, according to other people, he seemed really in love with her. So we really have no way of knowing at this point what it was all about, exactly.
Yeah, it's tough to parse out what's what.
It really is. But she denied that he was her fiancé. She was actually calling Scott her boyfriend, even though she's living with Carlin and Kent. So it's confusing.
It's quite confusing. Now, the police notified Kent's brother, Craig, as the next of kin of Kent's death. Craig had a difficult job telling his parents. Kent has told his father that if he had reason to believe he was dead, he should open the second letter. So they opened it, and after reading it, he called detectives in Anchorage, then faxed them a letter, faxed them a copy, and later sent them the original. So part of that note that he faxed to detectives read,
"Since you're reading this, you assume that I'm dead. Don't dwell on that. It was my time, and there's nothing that can change that. There are a few things that I would like you to do for me, though I hate to be vindictive in my death, but paybacks are hell. First of all, pay all my debt with the insurance money. That I owe you. Then go on a nice vacation, act like I'm there with you, and do the things I would like to do. Lie on the beach, fish, relax. 2 weeks minimum, but not much longer. Gary Brooks would like to own the Togiak, that was his boat. Give it to him if you can, otherwise sell it to him at a price he can afford. Owning the boat might make a difference in his life. Use the information enclosed to take Michelle down. Make sure she is prosecuted. Then he wrote, fraud. She took me for a lot of money on the impression that we were getting married. This may be hard to prove without me present, but give it a shot. It is a Class B felony in Alaska. $15,000 can be proved because you sent it to us. Then insurance fraud, he said. Have the IRS audit her. Turn her in. False driver's license and passport, he went on. Michelle, John, or Scott were the people or persons that probably killed me. Make sure they get burned. Sorry about giving you all of this stuff to do. I would have done it, but I wanted to make things work. I wanted to marry Michelle. If that would have happened, this would have all been destroyed. I have kept it as my insurance policy. Use it. I'll rest easier. Do me another favor. Make sure Michelle goes to jail for a long time, but visit her there. Tell her how much I really did love her. Tell her you love her and help her. She has a split personality, and the part I fell in love with is very beautiful. I really did want to marry her and make her dreams come true. Love ya, Kent.
Wow.
So there's a lot to unpack there.
I think so.
Yep. So unpack.
Well, I think the first thing would be that Kent knew what was going on, right?
He seemed to, but then he also is making excuses for her and wants his parents to kind of take care of her.
When she's in jail.
When she's in jail, yeah.
Yeah, but he wants her in jail.
Yes, he does. Yeah. So does he have kind of confusion there about her?
It seems so, doesn't it?
It really kind of does. And isn't it weird that if he's thinking this would be his last letter to his parents, he doesn't say anything about his childhood or his family or anything about that, really?
No, it's all about basically the present.
It kind of is. I mean, he does say that thing about take a trip and pretend I'm there, which is nice, I guess. And then it also kind of breaks my heart how he wanted to give the boat to Gary Brooks or give it to him at an affordable price, at least.
Yeah.
Saying the boat might make a difference in his life. I mean, that's very sweet. It's a very kind thing to say.
I don't think he was an unkind guy.
No, no. And I think you're right about that. I think he had issues. He had some maybe mental health or emotional problems, but a good guy really at heart. And I think that's important to notice. Clearly, he was angry with Michelle. But at the same time, he was kind of looking out for her, and he was certainly looking out for his ex-boss with the boat.
So the letter gave contact information for Michelle, John Carlin III, and Scott Hilke. Ken already knew who Michelle, John, and Scott were. Now, Kent had named his fiancée Michelle and his Alaska friends John Carlin III and Scott Hilke as the prime suspects in his own murder.
Yeah, which is pretty sad if you think about it. If he thought these were his friends, I don't know that Scott Hilke was really a friend of his. But
no.
Still,
well,
it's heartbreaking.
They all hung out at the club together.
Yeah, and kind of
maybe
competed for her.
Together. Yeah.
Yeah.
So reading this faxed copy of the letter in Anchorage, it was easy for DeHart to see that Kent Lepink was not as stupid and pathetic as some people thought he was. He certainly knew that his life was in danger, and he had taken precautions to get justice after his death by naming the people he thought were responsible for his death. So the letter might be shocking, but it shouldn't be a complete surprise that the main suspect he named was his fiancée. She also had a romantic relationship with Scott Hilke. How did Carlin fit in?
Kent was killed out in the woods. How did his car end up still in front of his house? Someone had to have driven that car back, so that's really suspicious to me. That points directly at one of them being responsible.
Yeah.
How else did he end up there? So John Carlin III was a husky, balding guy. He spoke to the trooper quite easily, seeming to have nothing to hide. He said that he had met Kent at a dinner party at the former home of Scott Hilke and Michelle in Wasilla. Hilke was living with her there, not Kent. Carlin claimed that the house they were in was damaged by a faulty vapor barrier that caused the walls to rot and caused the extensive water and mold damage. So Michelle had moved into Carlin's place in Anchorage in November of 95. 2 months later, in January of 96, Kent moved in with the two of them. Well, plus his son, so the three of them. So Carlin said that he believed Kent was gay. He didn't know of any enemies who would want to hurt Kent. He also said that Kent had a laptop computer that he always carried around with him. Carlin told the trooper that it was sometime between midnight and 2 a.m. on May 1st when he last saw Kent. He remembered that Kent had been watching TV. Carlin went to bed, and when he woke up in the middle of the night, he noticed that Kent had left. But his car, Carlin said, was still at the house. Carlin said that he was the major financial supporter for the repair work of Michelle's house in Wasilla. Carlin also said that he was involved in a romantic relationship with Michelle, and he had actually bought her an $11,000 diamond ring. So what does she do with these engagement rings? Yeah. Is she cashing them in? Because they really don't have great resale value.
No.
They don't. You lose a lot of money as soon as you take it out of the store.
So according to Carlin, Kent was always checking up on Michelle. And to get him to back off, Carlin wrote Michelle a note meant for Kent to look at, giving him the idea that she had a cabin in Hope. So that the letter was written to mislead Kent. He wouldn't know that Michelle had left the state and he would go after her. So Carlin said the note was put together by both him and Michelle, and it was left so that Kent would find it and believe that Michelle was in Hope, Alaska, and not Lake Tahoe, Nevada. And that's where she had really gone to be with Scott Hilke.
So do you think that that's possible, that the letter was just to kind of throw him off track of where she was, and it wasn't actually to lure him there?
No. Short answer.
Yeah.
And if he's engaged to her, Carlin, he's okay with her going to Lake Tahoe with Hilke?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was. And apparently the letter said that he was okay with her meeting up with a guy in Hope at a cabin he'd bought.
Yeah.
So it's all very bizarre to me.
It doesn't ring true.
So if detectives were understanding this correctly, Carlin was admitting to them that the note was a fake and that they were trying to lure Kent away from Anchorage and out to a remote area. And that's where he ended up being shot to death. So that's very suspicious.
Sounds suspicious to me, huh?
Yes. And at the same time, Michelle was away with her third man, Scott, in Tahoe. But there's not a lot of evidence, and that's the thing with this case. There's a lot of things that add up to them being responsible. But as far as hard evidence, it's hard to come by.
Yeah, you got that old circumstantial stuff, don't you?
Yes. And not even necessarily that strong of circumstantial evidence, unfortunately.
No. A lot of hints and suggestions.
Exactly, yes.
So in Michelle's second interview with the detectives, she said that she had last spoken to Kent on April 30th. This was a phone conversation because she was out of town. And she described his attitude at the time as stupid. He wouldn't give her any direct answers. She said it was a short conversation because she was frustrated with his non-answers. And she had charged the call to her Visa card, so she had proof that it actually had taken place.
Right. Well, John Carlin III walked in during this interview and was allowed to participate.
Yeah, they do it differently in Alaska, I guess.
Well, the detective asked Michelle if Kent had owned a gun, and Michelle answered that she knew for sure that Kent kept a handgun, which I think would be pretty common in a place like Alaska.
Uh-huh.
But he had lent it to her about a year earlier, she said, when some of the Alaskan Bush Company dancers took a gun safety course. When asked if she knew where the gun was now, Michelle turned to Carlin and she asked, "Have you seen that big black gun that Kent had?" And this really threw Carlin. He seemed very surprised by this question.
He said it got stolen in New Jersey. Of course he did.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be the same gun, but yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Right.
But he said he wasn't sure if he ever saw a gun that belonged to Kent. But Michelle wouldn't let that go. She persisted. She said that she was absolutely certain that Kent had owned a large handgun. She called the gun range where she'd taken the class and asked someone there to check the records for what model gun she had used. And when she got off the phone, she told the detective that it was a Desert Eagle 44.
Well, well, well.
This is startling.
No kidding.
Then when asked if she knew anyone who had anything to gain from Kent's death, she answered, no, nothing other than life insurance. And then she admitted that she was the beneficiary because Kent had changed the beneficiary to his parents and brother before his death, but she wouldn't have any way of knowing that.
Yeah. So as far as she knows, she's still the beneficiary.
Right. So that's pretty crazy because if they'd killed him for that and it had been changed, maybe he wouldn't have been killed if he didn't have that policy.
That's a strong suspicion.
It really is. Attorney and CPA Brian Brundin contacted the police after he read about the murder in the Anchorage Daily News. He told them that in September of 1995, Kent called and asked for his help in making a will. He told Brundin that until a loan on his boat was paid off, the bank and his father would have control over his fishing company. But he wanted Michelle to be his only beneficiary. On April 19th, which was just a couple weeks earlier, he went to his office and told Brundin that Michelle had an affair with a man they were living with last summer while Kent was out fishing. And this person was Scott Hilke. So I guess maybe he didn't know that this was an ongoing relationship between Scott and Michelle, if he thinks she was having an affair on him, who she's not even sleeping with. So his perceptions are just a little bit off for me.
Just a bit.
Kent and Michelle were living in Carlin's house, and Kent thought an affair was going on between Michelle and Carlin, and he knew that Carlin was giving Michelle money. Kent returned again on April 26th to the attorney, and this time he was very upset. He said that Michelle had taken him for a $10,000 computer, and also that things from his storage shed were missing. He also didn't know where his loving fiancée was, he said. He had already been to his insurance company and removed her as the beneficiary on his life insurance. He asked how he could change his will, because Michelle was the beneficiary, and Brundin told him, well, we can just tear it up, that's all we have to do. So that's what Kent did, and no other will was prepared for Kent by Brundin. That was the end of it.
A check with Alaska Airlines showed that a ticket had been purchased by John Carlin III using Scott Hilke's credit card for Michelle to fly from Anchorage to San Francisco on the same day that the ticket was bought. That was April 25th. And their records, Alaska Airlines records, showed that she departed from Anchorage at 3:16 p.m. that day, the 25th, and returned May 1st.
In interviews with Scott and other acquaintances of Michelle, detectives learned that about 10 days after Kent proposed to Michelle, she did accept. And right around the same time, Scott proposed to Michelle, and she accepted. Then Carlin proposed marriage around Christmas time, 1995. Michelle accepted that proposal as well. So she had three fiancés, all of whom knew the others, but didn't know the details of the relationships, because she's telling Kent and Scott that Carlin's impotent. She's telling Carlin and Scott that Kent is gay. She's really got quite a thing going on here with these guys.
Yeah.
Very twisted.
Uh-huh.
They were all giving her money and doing things for her, but she probably had no intention of marrying any of them.
Well, looking back at this case, yeah, that would certainly be my suspicion. She was just going to ride it as much as she could and get as much money as she could out of these guys.
Well, and I mean, they're kind of willing participants. So I don't know how much we can hold that against her.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not judging her.
Okay. But I don't know. In Kent's case, it does seem like she was really taking advantage of someone who was easy to take advantage of.
Yeah.
Michelle's sister Melissa called the Alaskan State Police, and she asked them if her sister had been involved in Kent's murder. She was actually suspicious because her sister had visited her and told her that Kent deserved it, meaning being killed, and also said, too bad he wasn't tortured before he died. So this paints a whole new picture of her.
Whoa.
As really terrible. Because at first I'm thinking, well, maybe she's just a flirt and that's the way she makes her money and that's fine. These men are willingly giving her money. But when I think about her saying such horrible things about a man who had just been killed and really had been nothing but nice to her as far as we know, she sounds evil. So Melissa explained that Michelle had sent Kent's laptop to her on May 6th, and Michelle wanted her to clear the laptop of emails. But she refused to do it. When Michelle left her sister's house, she took the unerased laptop with her. She was heading to New Orleans, Louisiana, to visit their mother, Sandy McWilliams. So Melissa gave the police her mother's address and also told them who her mother's employer was so they could get a hold of her.
Now, John Carlin was clearly in love with Michelle, and he'd do anything for her. Of course, money was what she liked to have the most. Carlin had gone and paid $18,000 down payment on a new RV. The information learned from the interview with Melissa and other sources made it obvious that Michelle was a pretty smart woman. So she's traveling in this new RV and probably covering her tracks as best she could.
Yeah, the Alaska State Police requested assistance in locating Michelle, a suspect in a homicide who was driving an RV to New Orleans. Alaska wanted them to locate Michelle and get a search warrant for that laptop computer. It could contain evidence for the murder investigation, for sure.
Absolutely.
So in early July, Michelle was found, along with John Carlin IV, at the Fountain Blue State Park in St. Tammany Parish.
And after getting a search warrant, police found a computer on the kitchen table inside the RV. And there were how-to discs by the computer, including one on how to boot up a computer. I should read that, shouldn't I? The computer and discs were confiscated, and the teenaged Carlin was asked how he ended up leaving Alaska and driving down to Louisiana. He said that he and Michelle drove down to live in a house that she was going to buy, and his father was planning to meet them in New Orleans.
Well, the state police clearly had formed a theory by now that Michelle and fiancé number two, John Carlin III, had lured fiancé number one, Kent, out to Hope, Alaska. There he was ambushed and shot. When he turned his body on impact, Carlin, who they thought pretty sure would be the shooter, shot him again in the chest, and the last shot in his cheek was meant to kill him if he wasn't already dead. Considering the killer had been using a .44, this was really considered overkill and likely very personal. So maybe we say it's for the insurance, but maybe Carlin didn't like Kent being around if he was in love with Michelle too.
Well, can eliminate one of the fiancés, that's good for him, right?
Exactly. Further investigation had shown that while she originally said she was out of town when the homicide happened, she had returned to Alaska with enough time that she could have technically been involved physically in this murder. Because we don't have a very specific time of death.
No, there's, probably like a day and a half?
Yeah.
Where it could have happened?
But I'm thinking she went to Lake Tahoe purposely so she'd have an alibi.
Sure.
So I don't really think she was physically involved. But that's just my opinion. What do I know? She could have been.
When they were approached by police after the discovery of Kent's body, Michelle and Carlin were found searching through Kent's belongings at the Wasilla house.
Yeah, right. Now, remember, they'd claimed that he had stolen things from them that they were trying to recover. But their timing is very curious.
Yeah, because they hadn't even been notified by anybody that Kent was dead. And here they are already going through his stuff.
Yeah, that could be evidence of guilt.
Could be, right?
Yeah, at the very least, it's odd, wouldn't you say? And at most, it's evidence that they already knew Kent was dead.
Yeah.
So, like we said, the case building against Carlin and Michelle was circumstantial. And the problem was the gun wasn't found, and there was no incriminating DNA either. There's no record that shows that the Wasilla Police Department spent any money at all investigating Kent's murder or assisting the state police. So I think that's part of the problem why it took so long to get this case to trial. The state police ran out of resources and the case just went cold.
Yeah, I mean, they ran out of money and stopped doing anything.
Yes.
Basically. So Carlin returned to New Jersey. And eventually Michelle settled in Washington State. She got married. She married a doctor and was living in Olympia, Washington. She had earned a master's degree and was raising a young daughter.
Yeah, and she'd had a pretty good job as well. She'd had a pretty good job as well. In fact, they were kind of pillars of the community.
Yeah. Well.
For over 8 years, Alaska and Kent were in her past, until detectives knocked on the door one day of her suburban home. It was 2004 when the state cold case unit reopened the investigation. After reviewing the earlier investigation, re-interviewing witnesses, and gathering forensics of emails and other information found on the two recovered computers, the Alaskan police and prosecutors concluded that they had evidence that Carlin had lured Kent to Hope, Alaska, where he shot and killed him, and they believed that Michelle was an accomplice. Although there was no proof that she was physically there during the shooting, they believed that she solicited Carlin to do it. She helped put together that note for Kent to find, making him think she'd gone to stay in Hope with another man, and she probably knew that he would go looking for her.
Probably. Then in 2005, Carlin's son, John Carlin IV, told the police that his father bought a gun from a classified ad in the newspaper. So they found the old ad, and they were able to reach the seller. Carlin's son also told police about something he'd seen just days after the murder. And he said, "I remember my father and Michelle. The gun was in the sink, and there was clear liquid in the sink, and it smelled like bleach. I didn't think they expected me home. There was a look of surprise." He wasn't sure if it was a Desert Eagle gun, but it matched the description. He also testified that his father was engaged to Michelle, and he saw Kent as an errand boy for Michelle and his father.
So Carlin was tried and convicted in April of 2007. Then Michelle was tried later that year. When her trial began that September, prosecutors said that she wanted Kent dead so she could cash in on that $1 million life insurance policy. So the state's case was thorough, but it was very circumstantial. The state presented the letter that Kent had sent to his parents on April 30th, right before he was killed. This was the letter telling them that if he was killed, it was probably Michelle and Carlin who were responsible. They also had a former co-worker and friend of Michelle testify about Michelle watching the movie, The Last Seduction, and saying that the protagonist was her heroine.
Now, that was I like that movie. Very dark movie.
What's it about?
Well, it's about a woman who steals money from her husband. He's a doctor who has a side business of providing narcotics to people. So she took the money, ran away, and convinced a pretty naive young man to kill her husband for her. And that way, she doesn't have to worry about him chasing her. And of course, she's promised the guy, you know, "Once you kill my husband, we'll be together. Life will be excellent. We can't wait. Blah, blah, blah." So he kills her husband, but she screws him, and he ends up going to prison. And she gets away with all the money.
So the fact that Michelle would say this woman's her hero, I'm not getting a good picture of her as a person.
Well, if your hero's a murdering, philandering woman, it works, right?
I suppose, but I just don't think that's evidence of anything, though. These are just not really. I guess the letter is something, but it's really not admissible. We're going to find out that wasn't really going to work out.
No, but I think the letter speaks a lot more than somebody saying, "Yeah, we saw this movie and Michelle really liked the lead character."
Well, as evidence, yes, it's right. Far above it. But when I think of what her sister Melissa said, that Michelle said about Kent after he died, some cruel things.
That's more telling.
That's very telling, yeah. Evidence of Kent's infatuation and devotion to Michelle, even as she dated these other men, became a big part of the prosecution's case against her. Family and friends had advised Kent to end this relationship, but he was pretty much obsessed with her. Kent's attorney, Brian Brunden, testified that Kent had visited his office several times in the weeks leading up to the murder. And Kent had called Michelle his fiancé and said that she was sleeping with Carlin on the side. When he visited Brunden on April 26th, Kent told him that Michelle had left and he didn't know where she was. And he said that his computer was missing along with some other expensive items. So it seems like she stole things from him and took off.
That's the implication.
And then sent him in the other direction, which just makes me think that she's just a cunning, manipulative, selfish person. And I don't see murder as something she wouldn't be capable of, especially soliciting one of her men that she controls so well to do it for her.
Yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm. Betsy Lepping, Kent's mom, testified that in April of 96, she got a call from Kent saying that he was driving up to Hope to find Michelle. She said she had tried to talk him out of going, but he wouldn't change his mind. He just needed to be with Michelle.
So Michelle was convicted of first-degree murder in October of 2007, and she was sentenced to 99 years in prison. Carlin was already in prison, and he appealed his conviction. But then he was beaten to death by fellow prisoners in 2008.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was something about he was getting kind of famous from the case, and he did an interview with somebody, and some of the other prisoners weren't cool with it.
Apparently not.
No.
Wow.
He had been offered to be put away from the general population and protected, but he couldn't stand being alone and having nothing to do, so he didn't like the solitary situation, and he wanted to go out and be in the general population, and ended up being beaten to death.
That's amazing.
It really is.
Then 2 years later, in February 2010, the Court of Appeals of Alaska overturned Michelle's conviction. The court ruled that the evidence of Kent's note blaming Michelle and Carlin for his murder, and the testimony by the ex-friend of Michelle's about the movie The Last Seduction, should not have been presented to the jury. So they determined that the evidence was unfair because the state's case was based on a large number of ambiguous facts pointing at Michelle's guilt. So they threw out the evidence and said new trial. It was ordered, and Michelle was released on bail in May of 2010.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that that stuff wouldn't be admissible. I read some on that, and I can understand that. But the stuff about the gun and the letter they wrote to him to mislead him, it still seems to me like they were guilty. Did they prove beyond a reasonable doubt? I guess not, but it still seems to me like they were guilty.
Well, we don't know about Carlin. He got beaten to death.
Right.
He was still in prison, so whatever appeals or whatever he had done, nothing came of those.
Yeah.
In
December of 2011, the indictment against Michelle was dismissed based on the ruling that the grand jury that had indicted Michelle had heard the inadmissible testimony. So prosecutors would have to present the admissible evidence to a new grand jury. As prosecutors considered whether to seek a new indictment against Michelle, her attorneys reinvestigated the case themselves. And they seemed like they were pretty good at their jobs. They were able to uncover evidence not disclosed to them in her first trial.
Yeah, and this is kind of explosive stuff.
It really kind of is. This is a big deal.
After Kent's murder, some of the family went to the prosecutors and said that they suspected Kent's father, Ken, who was involved in the killing. They told the defense team that they had spoken to state investigators about Kent's money embezzlement from the family and that he had borrowed more money to buy the fishing boat, which we know was losing money. Then his father had been in Alaska around the time of the shooting. Then the defense also found out that the lead detective in the case was writing a book about the murder at the time of the trial, which should certainly give him a financial motive to get a conviction.
Yeah, so when I read about the father, that was pretty stunning to me.
I guess.
I mean, of course, when you're just researching a case like this, you don't know what people are really like, what their personalities are like. And I had had the impression that his parents were pretty supportive and caring for him.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know if I believe that, but the family that went to prosecutors thought he was suspicious, and they knew him better than we do, of course. We don't know him at all. So that's a possibility.
Yes, it is. Do we know which family members went?
No. I would love to know.
Probably the brothers.
You think so? Boy, that's a messed up family if that's the case. I don't know. If it was the brothers, then I might think they have something there.
Well, I couldn't see the mother doing it.
No.
And certainly the father wouldn't incriminate himself.
No, I guess I was thinking maybe it was more distant relatives or not in the immediate family.
Well, possibly, but I think it would have to be the immediate family who knew about all this stuff.
Right. But if the prosecutors knew this and didn't tell the defense, that's a Brady violation. In 2012, after this new evidence was shown to the prosecutors, they decided not to seek a new indictment against Michelle because the evidence was insufficient to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. They have the option to charge her again. There's no statute of limitations. But with this case, which has been pretty well weakened by Michelle's attorneys, it's just not likely to happen. Now it's been almost another 10 years. With John Carlin III's case thrown out after he was killed in prison, his son sued the state of Alaska for wrongful death, and he got a $160,000 settlement. Now, there was some talk, what about the teenage son, John Carlin IV? Could he have killed Kent? Because you have to think, he was only like 6 years younger than Michelle. He was closer in age to her than the other men were.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with this.
Well, was there something going on? Because she drove out to New Orleans with that son, remember?
Right.
I don't know. Just throwing it out there is a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Why not?
It's possible. So Michelle tried to go back to her life in Washington State, but then in 2015, she and her husband, Colin, were separated. But they did work together at a skincare clinic that Michelle founded in Tacoma. I don't know if they're still working together, but their daughter's grown up now, and they're not together, at least as a couple.
Okay.
So Ken Lepink, Kent's father, died in 2014. His mom still visits Alaska, but she really has a hard time dealing with the fact that nobody was ever held responsible or accountable for her son's murder. I mean, what's going on here that nobody's being prosecuted? Somebody did it. Somebody had to have done it.
Somebody did it.
So why is time going by with no prosecution? I could see she'd be really frustrated. It bothers me.
There's a possibility that they're still investigating it. It's a cold case, right?
Yeah, it's not closed. It's cold, but yeah, it's still open, technically.
So there might still be things going on. Maybe they're hoping to find enough evidence to retry.
Retry Michelle?
Yeah.
So do you think she's responsible?
Responsible?
Yeah, for the murder.
I think she got this guy to murder her.
Well, that would make her responsible.
I think she's responsible in the sense that she got Carlin to murder Kent.
Okay. Well, that's conspiracy. So she got away with murder, really. At least that's what we think.
That's the opinion.
Yeah. So our sources for this case are a Dateline NBC, which was done in 2008 and updated in 2009. There's a Snapped episode from 2009, Season 7, Episode 4. There is a fairly recent People Magazine Investigates episode from 2018 titled Alaskan Temptress. Also, there's a lot of information in the SeattleWeekly.com archives. And there is some information about this case in the National Registry of Exonerations from January 2013. So it's a fairly well-known case. It's been around and out there.
Very interesting.
TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments for us, maybe a correction in pronunciation, a case suggestion, or even a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com. Or you can go to our website, tygrabber.com, and write your comments there. Or even better, leave us a voicemail. Your voicemail may be played on an upcoming episode, and we'd love to hear from you. I would say we probably play a good 50% of the voicemails, maybe even more than that.
I'd say more.
So it's not like when you send a voicemail to some huge conglomerate-type podcast. We're just a nice little family here.
Family-owned and operated.
That's right. So you're much more likely to get your word out there, get your voicemail played out there with us.
Yep.
If you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free and get extra members-only episodes and a gift, you might want to consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber at tiegrabber.com. Also, if you enjoy the show, we'd really appreciate it if you'd leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen.
Okay. Want some feedback?
I would love some feedback. Have we got voicemails?
Got a couple voicemails and a couple emails. So we'll do a voicemail first from Allison. She has a case suggestion.
Hello, Jill and Dick. My name is Allison. I'm a longtime listener and frequent voicemailer. So thank you so much for doing everything you guys do. I had a quick case suggestion for you. It's the Kitty Genovese case, and that's Genovese. It's a case that I think a lot of people have heard of and vaguely think they know about, but it's coming out that maybe there's a lot more to the case that we don't actually know. So anyway, she was murdered March 13th, 1964 in Queens, New York. And about 38 people witnessed her murder and did nothing to help her, according to a report in the New York Times. And this has come to be known as the bystander effect. And it's been studied and all that kind of stuff, that people stand by and do nothing to help. So the bystander effect came from this case, Kitty Genovese. But I saw that recently more detectives or people are looking into this case, and that finding out that that's not accurate. That's not actually what happened. So I was wondering if you would please cover it and bring it to light and let us know what actually happened in this relatively well-known case that is not what it seems. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you, Allison. So we did see a documentary on that on Netflix or something a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is a famous case.
Yes, really.
Very famous.
And I think it was recommended a few years ago, too, by someone. So I would be interested in covering it.
Yeah, I mean, there are some things. The first is that the statement that there were 38 or 37 people that were eyewitnesses and did nothing is probably not true. And that nobody called the police is definitely not true. The problem was that in 64, when this occurred, there was no 911 system. So you had to call up the precinct directly.
And, oh, yeah.
And there were a couple people that had called and the phone never got answered, things like that. It doesn't look like it happened exactly as the newspaper said. And that's another part of it is this is a story that appeared in the New York Times about the bystanders that did nothing. And there is a rival paper that had information that contradicted what the Times said, but they didn't want to go up against the Times, the powerful New York Times.
Wow, really?
But I think it'd be worthwhile looking into that.
Well, I think at the very least we could pull up the Times article and do some delving, right?
Sure.
Okay, great.
Okay, then we have another voicemail from Eden Rocks, which is a nom de plume. he has some observations for us.
Well, I like how he left us a little note that says, I hope the message is good. I freebased it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what that meant.
Now, is that a joke? Because I think that I accidentally say freebasing instead of freestyling. Or is this just another person who messes it up like I do? Or is it just a joke? I don't know.
I think it's just a joke.
Okay.
Who knows?
Okay.
I mean, once you hear
because freebasing is actually smoking crack, right?
Correct.
Yes. Okay. So hopefully he didn't smoke crack. But you never know. Let's listen and see.
Yep.
See how he sounds.
Hi, Dick and Jill. I'm going to give you my social media superhero alias and keep my name confidential. But my alias is Eden Rocks on social media. I do some stuff. I have some supporters. And I want to leave a voicemail to tell you that I really enjoy your podcasts. I stumbled upon them. Somehow, because I do, one of my hobbies is true crime, and I'm a professionally trained entertainer in many fields, so it is refreshing to me to hear people that are not that, but just sort of, you know, regular people that are just exploring their passions, and I've got roped into it, and your chemistry and, you know, the way you guys go back and forth and your insights, and I just really appreciate it, because you're just real people. And you're doing it because you care. So it's kind of, it's hard to explain, but you guys are artists after all, and I really appreciate it. So I don't have a case suggestion or a beer suggestion, but, and this might be all out of order because I just watched the videos as they come up on YouTube, but I had some, an insight on the Janelle Potter case, the one, the lady with the catfishing and her mother. And my point is I was thinking about those three stones that they called the cops, apparently, you know, okay, so the two unfortunate victims were named on two of the stones. And the third stone upon was written, I'm your Huckleberry, right? So you guys didn't touch on this, but that's actually a line from Tombstone where Doc Holliday shows up at the end with the bad guy and says, I'm your Huckleberry. So I can see the mom. And Dick, that's a great insight where you think the mom is running the whole thing and playing everything. And I have to agree, and I didn't think about that before. That's just one of the merits to listening to your podcast. So I could see the mom just watching Tombstone. I'm your Huckleberry, and that's what it is. It's just some line from a movie that sounds cool. And that's a crazy case. So that was the insight. And also, you know, guys, you guys are blowing up, right? You're on the precipice, blowing up. I know you have a theme song already that you use in your programs, but why not do a commercial? Why not, like, go out full on blast with an ad and do something fun, like a commercial jingle? Because that's what I do. A pop rock jingle with a music video, rock opera harmonies, something kind of cool that the young people can get into. So go ahead and send me a DM. Look me up. I'm Eden Rocks on Twitter. Anyway, I appreciate the work you guys do, and I'm a fan. I'm going to continue listening. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Boy, I can really tell he's an entertainer.
Can't you?
He's very active.
I think he should be our publicist.
Very energetic, yeah. So I didn't know the Huckleberry was from Tombstone. That's really a fascinating thing.
Yeah. See, we learned something.
We did. And I don't really know if we're up to doing that kind of pop rock commercial stuff, but I think that Eden Rocks could probably do a good one.
He could. I think.
Yeah, we're pretty low key here at the quiet end.
I'm a little too reserved. But I had to play that voicemail. He's just so out there and enthusiastic and sounds like he enjoys himself.
That's wonderful. And some great insights, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay. We're going to do a couple emails now. The old snail mail type of thing.
Okay. The first one is a case suggestion from Sherry. Sherry writes, love your podcast. Have been following for several years and look forward to each Monday for episode release. Thanks, Sherry. That's really flattering and nice of you to say. She goes on to write, I have a recommendation for a podcast, The Murder of Trish Willoughby. She was murdered while on vacation in Rocky Point, Mexico with her family by her husband Dan and his mistress Yesenia Patino. Yesenia was later found to have had a sex change several years prior, which Dan was unaware of. Trish had built a rather lucrative multi-level business with her mother, and Dan murdered her for the money and the mistress. Several trials took place related to the mistress changing her stories. So were you able to find out anything about this one?
I just quickly looked, and I don't have really much to add to Sherry's note. It does sound, just the whole thing about the mistress having had a sex change piqued my interest, so I'll look into it some more.
Yeah, but being murdered by her husband while they're in Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. That's a strange one.
Let's look at that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Sherry. And then the next case suggestion is from Chanel.
Yeah, Chanel, it's a brief note. She says, I thoroughly enjoy and am intrigued by y'all videos. Can you please do one on Imani Moss? It's truly a horribly gone wrong Cinderella story.
Ooh.
Well, it is. Well, yeah. The Cinderella story is that there's a wicked stepmother, and she killed Imani.
Was Imani an adult?
No, Imani was a young child.
So this is a child abuse, torture, murder?
Torture, murder, starvation, horrible stuff. So from a pediatrician's aspect, I doubt that I want to do this case.
Well, I know you feel that way, Dick, but you really have so many great insights and stories like that to share with us. Well, I know that we can only do these rarely because they are painful and really upsetting to do. It brings to mind the Sylvia Likens case, which was just horrible. I had trouble sleeping after reading about that. But it's certainly something we could consider doing, because I think it's a bit of a public service to bring that out and to talk a little bit about signs of abuse, the psychological aspects, all the kind of stuff that we love to talk about.
I'll think about it.
That's all I'm asking, is that you think about it.
Okay, I
will. So thank you, Chanel. I'm going to work on him.
Work away.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I'm not leaving the quiet end. I still have some more beer to drink.
All right. Well, you drink your beer, and I'm going to edit this, and we'll see everyone next time at the quiet end.
We got a seat right at the bar.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.